This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West here on RN and on your pod, turning out the big names to confront the sin of racism. A call for religious leaders to hit the streets to fight prejudice.
Pope Francis last week in his weekly audience said that we cannot claim that we are defending the sacredness of human life if we turn a blind eye to the reality of racism.
That's ahead on the show. Also today, the clock is ticking on Israel's plan to annex parts of the Palestinian West Bank. A former Israeli intelligence officer warns of the consequences. In 2018, the New South Wales Parliament unanimously passed legislation to combat modern slavery, a trade that the human rights group Walk Free estimates captures up to 45 million people around the world. New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian strongly supported the bill, but 2 years on, it has not been enacted. Well, now a coalition of prominent Catholic lawyers, which also includes actually Australia's former ambassador to the Vatican, John McCarthy, has written to the Premier urging her to implement the bill. Barrister Michael McCauley is president of the Thomas More Society, which drafted the letter.
It's great legislation because it creates effective means of ensuring that the question of slavery will be introduced, because it introduces a slavery commissioner, it addresses the questions of supply chains, and it provides for orders to be made to prevent people engaging in businesses involving slavery, and it also establishes a committee of parliament to report. So it's amongst the best legislation in the world. It has real teeth. It doesn't rely on voluntary reporting, and it's got an anti-slavery commissioner who can give effect to the legislation.
The UK's first anti-slavery commissioner, Kevin Hyland, has in fact said this may be world-leading legislation. Given that praise, why is this legislation not in operation in New South Wales? What problems have they said they've discovered?
There are no problems. What there are interests. There are commercial interests who don't wish this legislation to actually commence, and they're bodies which are represented by lobbyists in New South Wales, and they're bodies which would wish that the Modern Slavery Act 2018 simply sit on the shelf, as it were, never ever to commence. That's a sad thing. It's an indictment of politics in New South Wales. In an effort to sideline the legislation, it was referred off to a Legislative Council committee in 2019. But not unsurprisingly, the committee, when it looked at the legislation, endorsed the legislation and suggested some improvements, but endorsed it and suggested that it should commence as soon as possible. But there seems to be, within the New South Wales government, this reluctance to allow the legislation to commence, and a very great reluctance to explain why. I've spoken to various members of parliament on both sides of politics, and amongst some of the Liberal members, there's disquiet and unhappiness that this legislation hasn't commenced, because they see that it is reformist legislation, that it respects the human dignity of everyone and the human rights of everyone. So there are people in the New South Wales government who are unhappy that this legislation hasn't commenced, and they're embarrassed.
It's important to point out the non-partisan nature of the bill. It was originally moved by the former Christian Democrat MP Paul Green. It was strongly supported by the Labor MP Greg Donnelly, the Greens leader David Shoebridge. I notice that some of those interest groups in New South Wales that you're talking about. And I'm reading here directly from a New South Wales parliamentary report from March this year. The New South Wales Business Chamber, the Chartered Accountants, the Housing Industry Association, the Australian Institute of Company Directors, they claim that separate legislation in New South Wales is unnecessary because there's national legislation. Do they have a point?
No, they don't have a point. They're just finding reasons. The Commonwealth legislation, while it's better than nothing, is voluntary legislation. There are no penalties on reporting bodies for failing to report in relation to supply chains that are based on slavery. There's no anti-slavery commissioner. There's no committee of the federal parliament that considers this on a regular basis. The great advantage of the New South Wales legislation is that it has teeth and it will work if allowed to work. The Commonwealth legislation also seems to have been dominated in its operation by commercial bodies who have got an interest in impeding its effective operations.
I'm looking at the Modern Slavery Expert Advisory Group that oversees the Commonwealth legislation. Yeah. It has people from Telstra, from David Jones, from Lendlease, from Bunnings on it. Do you have problems with the composition of that advisory group?
Yes, there should be community representatives, there should be representatives of church groups, there should be academics, there should be lawyers, with no financial interest in preserving existing supply chains. There should be a much broader representation. There should also be union representation because unions are an important part of the Australian community. The state legislation is far superior, but it's not inconsistent with the Commonwealth legislation, and hopefully in due course the Commonwealth legislation will be amended to improve it. There's no reason why both the state and the federal legislation should not work harmoniously together.
The main difference seems to be that in New South Wales, it's any company with a turnover of $50 million a year. The federal legislation, I think, says any company with a turnover of more than $100 million a year would have to provide updates on their supply chains to ensure there's no slavery used. That's a very, very big difference in the dollar figure. What can happen, Michael, when it comes to the exploitation of workers?
It means that the catchment of the federal legislation is far less broad. Then you also take into account that the federal legislation has no financial penalties. It's true that the federal legislation allows the minister to name and shame non-compliant entities, but in the state there are criminal penalties of substantial amounts for failure to prepare a statement, failure to publish a statement, and providing false or misleading information. Voluntary regulation never works when there's money involved.
Barrister Michael McCauley, President of the Thomas More Society. Now, the Office of Premier Gladys Berejiklian tells the Religion and Ethics Report, quote, "The Standing Committee on Social Issues tabled its report on the anti-slavery legislation on the 25th of March, and the government's response is due later this year. The government is carefully considering the committee's recommendations." Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has set July 1 as the date for the formal annexation of Palestinian territory in the West Bank. Under Donald Trump's self-titled deal of the century for Palestinians, Israel would keep swathes of land on which it's already settled hundreds of thousands of people, many of them Jewish nationalists. But critics say annexing territory would finally end any chance of establishing a viable and contiguous Palestinian state. Not only are there ethical issues, but also strategic ones. Dr. Eyal Meiruz of the University of Sydney is a former Israeli intelligence officer, and he's been raising the alarm.
The plan is in line with Trump's so-called deal of the century. And it aims to unilaterally apply Israeli law, which is an attempt to avoid the word annexation, to potentially most existing Israeli settlements in the West Bank, including some around Jerusalem, but also along the Israeli-Jordanian border.
And in between those settlement blocks, the ones in East Jerusalem and the ones along the Jordanian border, there is supposed to be land for the Palestinians. It is supposed to be an independent state. Is that right?
Well, the plan is pretty much following actually the Israeli line rather than any going towards the Palestinian interests. There is some sort of a plan for Palestinian states, but it will take 4 years and a lot of goodwill on the part of the Israelis and a lot of more than goodwill on the Palestinian part to take up this plan.
It will take more than goodwill on the part of the Palestinians. It will take absolute sacrifice, won't it? Because were they to accept this proposal, they would end up with, I think, about 15% of historical Palestine.
Exactly. And that's what the Israelis have been failing to understand since the year 2000. Because from the Israelis' perspective, the offer given to the Palestinians in 2000 before the Second Intifada broke out was so-called 90% of the West Bank, and now it's 70%. But from the Palestinian point of view, this is tiny bit of what was promised to them in 1948 and what was theirs even beforehand. So the sacrifice has already been made by the Palestinians just by accepting the West Bank and the Green Line as a compromise. And the Israelis have failed to understand that for a long time. That is where the idea that there is no partner for peace on the Palestinian side has come from, and really two narratives talking past each other rather than understanding each other.
I mean, you've raised there some of, if you like, the moral issues, the ethical issues, but you also say there are very practical concerns here. What is your major concern, especially as someone who has been an intelligence officer in the Israeli military?
I think a lot of the Israeli military establishment agrees with me on this point. There are major fears of what is to come if Israel unilaterally and illegally goes ahead with their plan. And that starts with the fear of destroying the relationship with the Palestinian authorities, with the Arab world, a threat of an uprising that nobody really can foresee the consequences of what will take place, risks to the stability of neighboring Jordan and perhaps cooperation with Egypt, as well as annexation could in the long term create an Israel that is either Jewish or democratic, but not both. Because if the Palestinians are to become part of Israel, then sooner or later there will be a majority. And if Israel wants to hold on to its Jewish identity, then it will not be a democratic state no longer.
It seems to me, just reading a lot of commentary and reading the direct quotes of many Israeli politicians, that doesn't really bother them, this idea that Israel in international eyes will no longer be considered democratic.
Well, I think that there is a wide scope of, when you talk about the Israelis, there's a broad range of views. And so today's, and for some years back, the majority of the Israeli public is holding what we call right-wing views. And to varying degrees, they are more concerned about ideology, some of them, than the practical threats, and they are willing to, even if these so-called doomsday predictions will take place, they are willing to accept the costs because the ideology here plays a much more important role than the politics of it, if you like.
What are the implications if Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, actually follows through this time on his promise to end all security and intelligence cooperation with Israel?
Yes, this I think is the second major issue that a lot of Israelis are concerned about, because the Palestinian Authority has effectively been the arm of Israeli security forces in the West Bank for the last 20 odd years. And certainly if the Palestinian Authority no longer plays ball, then the Israeli army would have to go in case of trouble, and that could easily ignite another uprising. On the other hand, again, the Israelis or the Israeli right or the Israeli government is counting on because the Palestinian Authority is so much dependent economically and in other ways on Israel and the U.S., that they will once again make the threat but not go ahead with it. The issue is that Abbas is really on the way out. He's very, very old, and there's already some succession fighting going on, who's going to succeed him. And so we don't really know what is going to happen from the perspective of the Palestinian Authority. It could even dissolve.
But right now, doesn't Israel control the Palestinian territory with very few of its own troops? It relies essentially on electronic surveillance plus this very tight relationship with the Palestinian security forces. If effectively the security forces dissolve themselves, does that mean 19-year-old Israeli conscripts back on every street corner in every village in Palestine in their territory?
Yes and no. I mean, yes, the Israelis might have to go back into those A and B, so-called A and B territories. But if the Palestinian Authority dissolves itself, it doesn't mean that there are no longer strong militia groups and strong security forces on the ground from on the Palestinian side. But what will they do and how will they react, and whether they will be fighting against Israel is an unknown at the moment.
You're now an Australian resident, an academic at the University of Sydney. What's your view about the way Australia has handled this Israeli threat of unilateral annexation of Palestinian territory?
Well, I've been in Australia for over 20 years now. To say the least, I'm not very happy with Australia kind of following the footsteps of the Trump administration in relation to its support of Israel on the Palestinian issue. I think Australia so far has been silent and did not join many of our allies and friends in Europe and elsewhere around the world in condemning and opposing such a unilateral step. And I would certainly wish for Australia to take a more active stance, because even though Australia on its own may not change things, the very fact it will oppose the step may affect maybe even the Trump administration, who has been getting used to Australia supporting its pro-Israel stance in international fora. Australia has been supporting the two-state solution for a long time. So in line with its own policy, voice its views against a unilateral step of annexation by the Israeli government.
That's former Israeli intelligence officer Eyal Meruz, who's now at the Department of Government at the University of Sydney. And you're with me, Andrew West.
Hello, my name is Brooke Williams, George Floyd's niece, and I can breathe. Long as I'm breathing, justice will be served. My uncle was a father, brother, spiritually grounded. Their officer showed no remorse while watching my uncle's soul leave his body. He begged and pleaded many times just for you to get up, but you just pushed harder. No more hate crimes, please.
That's Brooke Williams speaking at the funeral of her uncle George Floyd, the unarmed black man killed by a police officer in Minneapolis 2 weeks ago. Several officers have now been charged over Mr. Floyd's killing, which set off demonstrations and, yes, some violent riots. It also raised some uncomfortable questions about how some expressions of religion have fueled racial prejudice. For Brian Massingale, it's personal. He's an African-American Jesuit priest and professor of ethics at Fordham University in the Bronx, and he has his own experience of racism. Brian Massingale says George Floyd's death has now taken on a religious significance.
The spot where George Floyd was killed, what we see there, people calling deliberately sacred ground. This appellation, sacred ground, is coming not simply from religious types, but from people who don't necessarily have any formal affiliation with the church. But I think what they're trying to call our attention to is that there's something going on here which should transcend partisan divisions, that this is a moment of spiritual healing, and that racism, the wound of white supremacy that has afflicted this country since its foundation, raises profoundly spiritual questions that the nation has to grapple with if we're ever going to deal effectively with this terrible social wound.
Father Massengale, I believe you want to see more collars. We're talking here about the white clerical collars. You want to see more of them on the streets.
Absolutely. This is pointing out a very uncomfortable truth about Christianity in the United States, and that Christianity in the United States has been complicit in the racism in the United States. It's done this through a permissive silence. For example, many of the students I teach at Fordham University, I routinely ask them in my classes, when is the last time you heard your priest or your rabbi or your minister speak about racism as a spiritual issue, as a sin? And sadly, but not surprisingly, most of my students will say they never heard their religious leader address these issues in the course of their worship service. And so, yes, we do need to have more visible clergy presence, but I think it goes beyond that. We need for the churches to finally explicitly name racism as a profoundly spiritual issue and spiritual challenge, and not simply as a political or a social issue.
I'm also wondering about the capacity, though, of the religious institutions to liberate as well, because the civil rights movement, born on the back of the wonderful black church movement. So how can the entire church, the white church as well, be used to advance that anti-racist cause?
You're echoing a very, very important point. Martin Luther King once said that the greatest mistake that he made was to overestimate the Christian faith of the white Christian church. He presumed that when he began his civil rights crusade, that many white Christians would see the morality of his cause and would come to his aid and support. And sadly, he found out that most white moderate Christian religious figures and leaders were silent, were absent. What we're seeing now, and I'm cautiously optimistic here, and I stress the word cautiously, is that there seems to be somewhat of a turning point here. There are more and more mainstream Christian entities, for example, religious publications, religious outlets, religious broadcasters, who are now giving far more attention to this issue than they ever did before. That indeed is something to be applauded. What we also saw was that Pope Francis last week in his weekly audience said that we cannot claim that we are defending the sacredness of human life if we turn a blind eye to the reality of racism. And we've also seen some Catholic bishops since then also devote far more space to this issue than they ever have before. However, there's still much to be done, but there does seem to be the beginning of some kind of opening for a renewed engagement, religious engagement with this terrible social issue.
What's your message, Father, to the, I think it was a very, very small majority of American Catholics who actually supported Donald Trump at the last election? I think it was 51 or 52%.
53% of white Catholics supported President Trump during his last election. And I think that this goes to the relevance and the importance of what Pope Francis said. Many Catholics used the excuse to support Donald Trump by saying that he was pro-life. And what we're seeing now from the Pope, and this is echoing the teachings of his past predecessor, Pope John Paul II, when he said that racism, concern for racism, is a pro-life issue. And what's happened in the Catholic Church all too often is that we've used pro-life as an excuse or a pretext to soft pedal our opposition to racism, saying, yes, of course, as Catholics, we're opposed to racism. However, the preeminent issue is that of abortion. And I think what we're finally seeing from the highest levels of the church is a concerted pushback against that kind of rhetoric and challenging Catholics then to say that their commitment to life has to move beyond abortion, but must include the sin of racism as well.
I want to end, Father Massengale, with a very personal reflection. Tell me about the time, and it wasn't so long ago, as I understand, when you went to fill in at a white Catholic parish. Now, you're a Catholic priest. You've been a Catholic priest for 40 years. The church recognizes and embraces.
Let me correct you there. It's been 37 years. Let's not make myself older than I am.
Okay, yeah. Brian, I won't age you too. But the point is, you are a respected, fully ordained Catholic priest. What happened when you visited that white parish to fill in?
Well, what happened was that a priest friend of mine had suddenly taken ill. And so he called me and asked me to take his Sunday Mass for him. And I said, yes. I showed up at this parish, which was overwhelmingly white in one of our suburbs of an urban city here. And I asked the usher to direct me to the sacristy. And he looked at me and he asked, why did I want to know? And so thinking that I was wearing my Roman collar, that should be an explanation enough. But I explained to him who I was and why I was present. And then he looked at me very suspiciously and he interrogated me. You're a priest. Who sent you? And so I explained the situation yet again, to which he then replied, at least he could have sent us a real priest.
Oh.
A real priest. Mm. It was rather painful, but again, it's not unusual. And I think that many, many Christians, when I tell that story, are appalled and shocked. But I think they'd be even more appalled and shocked and overwhelmed if they realized that this wasn't an isolated incident.
How did you look the congregation in the eye? I mean, you're a priest, you're compelled to love. I don't doubt that you do. But how did you look that congregation in the eye from the pulpit, especially when you were giving the homily?
That's a very good question. Part of me would want to say that in a moment, you kind of suck it up, you do what you have to do. But the other part of it, the Christian side of me, says that this is the reason why I'm ordained. I'm ordained to preach a message, and sometimes an uncomfortable message, precisely to those who need it, who may not want to hear it. And so for me, even though being a Catholic priest in an overwhelmingly white church, especially as a Black Catholic priest, it has certainly not been easy. And there have been times when I felt the sting of exclusion. What keeps me going is the deep conviction that this is my calling, that if I am not here, then the church is not who the church is called to be. The church is called to be a people of every race, language, and way of life. And so by God's help, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing, because if I'm not there, then the church is not truly the church.
The Reverend Professor Brian Massengale, a leading ethicist at Fordham University, a Jesuit priest. Brian's book is Racial Justice in the Catholic Church. Thank you very much for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you very much, Andrew. I appreciate the time being with you.
And that is the show for this week, ending with a little bit of music there from George Floyd's funeral. Catch us anytime on the podcast or at iTunes. Thanks to Mudita Dias and Tim Jenkins. I'm Andrew West. I'm back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.